It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See
terms and conditions. 18 plus. Forensic Psychology is a podcast that provides an illuminating window into the workings of the criminal mind. Now, here's your host, Dr. Carlos.
Welcome back, everybody. Today we have some great guests. Actually, we have two guests today who work in law enforcement, and they're experts in gangs, guns, and drugs. And that's today's topic, gangs, guns, and drugs. But they also host a podcast that I highly recommend. It's called the Disruptors Podcast. You can find more information on Instagram at the_disruptors_podcast. Purveyors of positive mental attitude, PMA, as they say, music, and a love for people from street cops to mosh pits. The hosts were BC Sanders and Skis. So they're going to be talking today about gangs, guns, and drugs, and a whole lot more. And folks, if you've been following the podcast, you know gang activity has been on the uptick for a while now in a lot of different places. We've had other gang experts from Minneapolis, LA, and New York, and it's really going crazy out there. So we'll be talking about that because it hasn't slowed down. Before we get started, you know what to do. Share, subscribe, hit that like button. You know we like it. Let's not waste any more time. Welcome BC and Ski to the show. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, man. We're glad to be back for me, and this is Ski's first time on, man.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, welcome, Ski, and thank you to be back. Good to be have you back, BC. You can't even talk. Welcome. Okay, well, I'm just going to leave it like that. It's good to have you back.
Yeah.
Why am I even pushing it? All right. Now, last time we brought you in, we talked about gangs, and I know we just ran out of time, like, ASAP. Because the topic is so huge. And you have such a wealth of knowledge, and I'm sure Ski does as well. I mean, even when you've spoken to my classes, I mean, they were blown away. You only touched the tip of the iceberg. So what I want to start off this question, I guess my first question will be, has it really gotten crazier in the last 2 or 3 years? Because every time I look in the news, and I get the cutesy thing the news does, you know, it's, oh, a bunch of adolescents. And they robbed the store. It's like, really? You get a lot of adolescents to just go around robbing stores all of a sudden? I mean, I don't know. This isn't the Bowery Boy days anymore. So it's kind of weird when you see this kind of stuff. But I get it. But is it really going on the uptick?
Yeah, I'll jump in. And then, and Ski, you can follow up. Sorry, I kind of jumped in. But the juvenile thing we've seen in the South escalate, or I should say our violent crimes escalate among juveniles, because several states or jurisdictions have lowered the arrest ages for the last probably 5 or 6 years. That's been the trend. So some states you could be 16 and get physically arrested, right? And like handcuffed and taken in, just like, you know, adults, 16, 17, 18 year olds. But when some of these states drop those ages, that, and it's sad, because the theory is drop the age and you don't have a juvenile getting pipelined into prison, right? At 16 or 17. But in the gang world and some of the organized drug world, that means, oh, well, now you can't get physically arrested. They have to go through the juvenile system and do some type of a juvenile petition or paperwork like that. And then someone has to decide whether the juvenile can be taken into custody and detained into a facility. And for a lot of crimes, they are not taken into custody for that. They're basically given like a court date. So you'll see jurisdictions where juveniles will escalate. They'll start out in larceny, shoplifting, nothing really happens. You know, there's no fire, not getting burned. And then it just escalates. The next thing you know, 16, 17 year olds are carrying AKs or ARs or whatever, pistols, and they're blasting people and getting caught in that cycle of violence. Also, they're younger, so their frontal lobe isn't fully developed, so they're doing impulsive things and peer pressure, just like any other thing at teenage age. So they get involved in gangs, and it's gotten really, really, really violent really fast in the last probably 3 or 4 years, I'd say.
Yeah, and I just kind of what you started off by saying, well, the media is talking about adolescence and going in and robbing. You know, obviously you're never going to get the accurate story from the media. Now, a group of adolescents, they don't just decide one day that they're going to go ahead and just go rob a convenience store, a gas station in their neighborhood, right? That could be a one-off of that, but they're being directed, right? And that's what a lot of people fail to understand is these 13, 14-year-old kids, they're being swooned in by these older gang members. And the whole purpose, if you really strip it back, is to grow this criminal street enterprise and bring money to the gang, right? They all want to make money. That's why they're out there, right? So they got these 13, 14-year-old kids that are being told by these higher-ups, your OGs, the guys on the block calling the streets, and they're directing them like, hey, you guys aren't going to get arrested because you're juveniles. We need you to go in there with a firearm, and we need you to rob them, and we're going to pay you $50 cash, and you're going to give us the rest for the gang because you're a good gang member, right? They pump them up, they puff them up, right? So these kids are just kind of being brainwashed at a young age into this criminal element, and they feel a part of it, you know?
That's a great point, because I know, speaking of former gang members, a lot of them had issues with dads, either lack of dads, dads in prisons, or didn't have a father, never knew who they were. And a lot of these, and you guys can see if I'm right or not on this, at least from everything I've heard, the older gang members are more sophisticated, the ones who are usually the recruiters, the ones who are usually the I hate to say the groomers, but the ones who are hiring them on, tend to replace the role of the father in a lot of ways. They show some kind of version of a care, caring, empathy in a sense. You know what? You mean something to us. You can be important here. Am I far off on that?
No, you're dead on the money. And that's when you use the word grooming, it is exactly grooming. I mean, really, in like the same way or the same sense that a sexual predator may do that with a child and groom the child. Sadly, we see that, you know, a small percentage, at least this documented, of gang members were sexually molested as children or juveniles. And that explains sometimes maybe that feeling of abandonment, or if they're, you know, they've got a single parent and you know, you sort of learn some of the background like that. And then you realize, okay, here's a kid at 14 or 13 or 14. And it finally comes out they were molested, and maybe, you know, they didn't get the therapy or the help that they needed. And then here comes, like you said, an older male figure who steps in and kind of acts as a protector or shows them this is love, this is family, you know. So even like when you watch kids get jumped in, you know, the ceremonies where it can be Bloods, Crips, Sereños, like whatever the gang is, when they do that jump in, you see young men and women after they get beat up and they get that rite of passage, everybody comes in and hugs them and calls them, you know, brother or sister, you know, tells them how much they love them. And it's like this, like I said, like a rite of passage. You see it in the military too, when someone graduates from airborne school or air assault school or whatever, and they get blood wings beat in their chest or blood rank, you know, is beat into their collars or need their knee spears to the thigh in the Marine Corps, whatever. That rite of passage, like, now I feel like I'm part of something. They feel it. And then it's more of the family. And so if an older person comes to them and asks them to commit a crime, it's not necessarily looked down upon. It's more like, we got to do this for each other. You know, I would do this for you, you know, and then the younger kid's like, yeah, of course, kind of thing. But like Ski's saying, we've listened to gang meetings where ranking members who are very, very manipulative will actually tell somebody, you have to do this shooting because you can't do, they can't sentence you to the time they can sentence us because we're adults. And so you hear 15, 16, 17 year olds, you know, up and being like, yeah, I'll put in work, you know, I'll do that 00 or whatever, you know, whatever the code is for that gang. That's the East Coast blood talk. But you know, to step up and do it. Go ahead, Ski.
The interesting thing is too that family, that brotherly love thing, it's a facade, right? There's a few small percentage of gang members that we call like true believers, right? if there's 50 kids in a gang, in a neighborhood gang, like 47 of them, they don't actually want to be in that gang, right? They're not buying the love thing, this and that. And a lot of these older guys, they rule by fear, right? But these kids, they don't have a whole lot to turn to. So at least they feel part of something. But if you get these guys one-on-one, they don't like that lifestyle. Like, as much as they want you to believe that they're all in and they're this hardcore gang member, the second they can walk away, if they could, they would, right? Am I right on that, BC?
Yeah, and like Ski's talking about, like, the true believer, the predator mindset, you know, the mercenary. Like, we break it down into, like, different motives or different mindsets, so that when we train officers, deputies, agents, hey, don't see every gang member the exact same. Don't see the gang set the exact same. 8 Trey Crips can move completely different than 5 Deuce Hoover Crips, or, you know, 7-4 Hoover criminals are going to be something completely different than, say, Treetop Piru, right? Could still be in the same city, could still be the same crimes being committed, but the organizations themselves operate a little bit differently. So for law enforcement, you know, we hate using the analogy, but it's like different agencies. So NYPD is going to operate a little differently than LAPD. Our agencies in the South may operate differently. We're still police departments, but I myself and Ski are going to operate and have a different kind of cultural training. I don't know. That was a dumb word, but you know what I mean? Like our culture in our department may be, hey, you got to be physically fit. You got to be serious about your firearms training, your verbal skills, you know, de-escalation, like stay locked on, read books, get good training. And then we could go work with some other agency and they maybe have a different regime. Like, it's okay to carry an extra 30 pounds, or it's okay if you don't really train a lot, you know, it's okay. We just don't have that much crime kind of thing. So it's the same thing in the gang world. Like some gangs are very, very organized, very smart in how they recruit. And they may ask a lot of their members. Like Gangster Disciples are all over the South now, but they came out of Chicago. So you have the Gangster Disciple Nation, right? GDN. And you'll often hear like the Gentlemen of Distinguished Nature, like as a different way to refer to them. Or growth and development was a big term going back probably 20 years. Where Gangster Disciples
and development?
Yeah, where they kind of rebranded, you know. So right. Gangster Disciples, and I mean you can read this now, it's open source, but in the late 90s, early 2000s, they basically rebrand and call themselves Growth and Development, and then get federal grant money from, I believe it was Clinton's.
Come on.
Yeah, Clinton's administration at the time. Yeah, because they're based in Chicago. So it's that idea that the Chicago culture of gangs and committing crimes is, how do we basically get our hands inside the political system? If we can win the hearts and minds of the neighborhood, we can hide among the neighborhood and they'll protect us against the police. Go ahead.
You can actually look on YouTube. You'll see videos of them around Christmas time doing like a neighborhood Christmas gift giveaway with big stack of presents and all that. And it looks good. It looks warm and fuzzy and feel good. And for the people that can't see through it, they're like, these aren't bad guys. They're just misunderstood. No, they're a criminal enterprise and they're doing, you know, exactly what they're doing to suck people into that, to make them look the other way and think, you know.
It's amazing because it reminds me a lot of the mafia.
Nothing's
changed.
Back to your initial question, right? Is it actually getting worse? Is it getting better? I think the answer is it just ebbs and flows, right? It depends on the city you're in. It depends on the county you're in. Depends how much pressure they're getting, right? Because, like, you know, in a city that's really locked in and they're handling their gang problem, they're just going to push it somewhere else. You're not going to get rid of it, but you can push it somewhere else, right? So maybe if you're in a major city, you might end up seeing them pop up in one of those little outlying towns, and all of a sudden that area is just riddled with graffiti and open-air drug sales and this and that. And the question is, like, well, where'd they come from? Well, probably got pushed out of that jurisdiction that's locked into doing gang work, and it's proactive about it, right? So I don't think – you know, I don't know. I don't think it really ever changes a whole lot. Like, as far as recruitment and number of gang members, I think they go to prison. I think a lot of them die off and get killed. A lot of them grow out of it, but you always have this new cycle of new blood coming in, you know?
And we're also are dependent upon officers and agents and deputies being able to document what they're seeing. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you were to ask us, hey, how many gangs do you have in your city? And I say, oh, easily 55 separate gang sets. So we may have up to like 20 separate blood sets, West Coast in origin and East Coast in origin. And we can sit down and break all that down and then go to another city that's more violent than ours and may only have very few gangs, but because they can't document it, because they don't recognize the hand signs, or they don't see the difference between this Piru and, you know, this Bloodstone Villain or whatever. Like, they just think, oh, a blood is a blood or a Crip is a Crip. And so, whereas we may get down into the weeds of it and know everything from hand signs, rank structure, how many members we have, a lot of that is dependent upon our patrol officers. And a lot of agencies miss that completely, especially in the South, because we're still trying to catch up as a region. You know, we don't have gangs going back 40 and 50 years. Gangster Disciples go all the way back to like the late 60s, early 70s, you know. So same thing in L.A. You can go back to 68 and Crips are first getting documented as, you know, juveniles, or 1969. We didn't have that. We're dealing with about a 20-year span, you know. So for us down here, that's why Ski and I and others that we've worked with have worked so hard to train other people to get them to be able, like an officer, to be able to see somebody, see how they're dressed, see their mannerisms, maybe, you know, do a phone extraction and go, I can tell you from the text messages that this suspect sent that he is Grape Street Crip, right? Just from a text message, because the way they may put in a text and use certain numbers and letters. And I won't bore you with all that, but if you can train people up to do that, then you get a more accurate read for research purposes and for forming strategies within the cities of how to address the violence. Right. Because if I know that there are two gang sets that are going to war or have beef over something, well, if Ski and I are on a drug unit, or we're on a Safe Streets FBI task force, then we don't need to be worrying about going over here and buying 3 kilos from a dude who's never committed a violent crime in his life. We need to be focusing our efforts on these two groups of people that are in the drug game, and they're only selling small, you know, bundles of heroin, or a little bit of coke here and there, or Molly or whatever. Well, let's get them on these small drug charges and break up that cycle. You know what I'm saying? So it's harder to shoot and kill someone when you're locked up in jail on, you know, selling whatever, 4 hits or 4 bundles of heroin or whatever. It might be in the drug world, it's like, oh my God, I could have gotten 3 kilos. Well, who cares? Nobody cares about the weight. We care about the arrest of a violent drug dealer and an actual documented gang member. Go ahead, Ski.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, man. A lot of cops that are working in the drug world and that, they like to, we call it the kilo ferry, right? You can chase that kilo ferry, right? And you can do these long-term investigations that ultimately lead to a seizure, right? But in that meantime, you're passing up all the stuff BC's talking about. I'd rather go out and go, yeah, that kid might only be selling dime bags of weed, and he's a very low-hanging fruit drug dealer, but he's like the most violent gang member in the city. I'd much rather him up on a couple weed charges and get him off the street. Maybe you get lucky and get him with a firearm or something. You know, there's a time and a place to chase that drugs, and we've got different units, DEA, and different units within the department that do that. But you can't, as a street cop, you can't overlook that low-hanging fruit. You're looking for the violent, you know, shot callers, right? And the ones that have pulled the trigger and all that. And that is what's going to make that gang problem start to shrink a little bit, when they go, man, they're really focused in on this very specific set of individuals because of their violence, this and that, right? You go into a city that has a population of 1 million people, there's probably only, you know, 30 or 40 dudes out on the street that are known to be the most violent ones there are, right? So if you can target those 30 dudes, pull them off the street, man, everything starts to plummet as far as your aggravated assaults and your shootings and your homicides and all that, right? So there's definitely strategy to keeping that influx from happening.
And that's where a lot of agencies too need to be able to focus on intel driven. So in other words, develop informants, develop sources within gangs, and then share that information as much as you possibly can with officers and other detectives. So in our areas, we do regional gang meetings. We do department gang meetings. And you literally will walk in and it'll be a 2-hour meeting. And the first hour is nothing but training. So because we have so many gangs operating in the South and where we are, that first hour is like, okay, we're going to go over, you know, Nine Trey Blood. We're going to go over everything about that set, all the way going back to their history, their hand signs, who's in what line, how it breaks down, some of the terminology, and we show some graffiti, some tattoos. We're going to get into some beef or some drama they may have, and then we're going to shift gears and come in and talk about Almighty Latin King and Queen Nation. So we're going to go over Latin Kings, and we're going to teach you all this in the first hour. And then the second hour is all crosstalk, and you talk about the crimes involved in gangs. So for us, I mean, the second hour could be, hey, we're going to talk about, you know, Orphans 13 beefing with TCS 13, or we're going to talk about whatever, you know, whatever that other gangs are. So because there's so many gangs and so much to learn, we have to constantly be harping on briefings like that to get people up to speed. And what we've learned is when we do that in a gang meeting, more and more people want to come to the meetings. So at one point, even though our department had its own gang intel meeting, we were inviting other agencies. So we had AUSAs coming in, federal prosecutors. We had FBI agents coming in. We had other surrounding jurisdictions. And everybody was like, hey, we really appreciate y'all taking the time to share the information and knowledge. And even if they didn't care about the second half, the first half, they walk away and go, well, at least I know about Nine Trey Bloods, you know, at least I know about Latin Kings now. So like in one of those meetings, we literally had a new ATF agent get assigned to our region or our area. And he went to the gang unit and said, hey, basically like I'm here to work. Like I want to go get guns off of gang members. That's my job. So he came to the meeting. That was like one of the first days I ever met him. I'm giving a briefing on 8-Trey Crips, right? 8-Trey Gangsta Crips, originally out of LA, but they're all over the South now. And I'm basically talking about it. And that was whatever, 10 o'clock in the morning, but like 5 o'clock that afternoon, he's still at work with our gang unit and they're buying a rifle off of a 8-Trey Crip. And ooh. I was like, okay, this guy's locked in. So the cool thing is like Ski and I have always been spoiled with really good ATF, DEA contacts, FBI contacts. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about working with federal agencies or doing things, it's always been really, really cool. So, you know, some people, you know, think there's like beef or egos. I mean, at least we've never experienced that. It's cool to be able to brief an entire group of people. And at that time, even district attorneys and stuff were in the meetings. And then to have this agent go out there, link up with a unit, and they're already buying a gun off of somebody. I mean, it's just when you focus like that, you do disrupt the violence. And I'm not going to sit here and crunch numbers and tell them to you, but that's what we were tracking and understanding. Like, okay, this is working. Like, we literally can go into a certain corner or area and focus all our efforts on it and share this information with other people. So if we are stopping guys, you know, say at a certain intersection, and we catch them with a gun, but their home address is a small suburb of the city we're in, we'll contact that source or that city. Hey, we've got one of your guys here. This is what we know. This guy is whatever, Latin King, and he's out here with a pistol, and we think he's beefing with whatever, this set, MS-13, whoever he's beefing with. Then that jurisdiction is thankful for that, and in turn, we can call them at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and say, hey, we need a favor in return. You know, remember the Latin King we told you about? Well, we need help with this guy. You know, he's a Grape Street Crip. He's living in your city. He's got a warrant, but we think he's going to come to our city and do a shooting based on other information. Can you prioritize and go lock him up on his existing warrant? And then we'll be able to listen to his jail phone calls, and we'll also interrupt this cycle of violence. So it's almost like if you can get plugged into all that drama and develop sources and share information, sometimes you can actually get ahead of the shooting that is planned. I mean, a lot of them are sporadic, and we're seeing that now, like impulsive shootings. But if you can get into that cycle, you actually watch the shootings and the violence go down. So like a lot of cities, people say, oh, well, the homicide rate is so high, it's such a violent city. But then what you may understand is that they may have a lot of homicides, but that's because where most of their violence is, could be miles and miles and miles away from the closest hospital. And even that closest hospital doesn't have a really good ER or trauma center. So some cities, their most violent neighborhoods are so close to the hospital, they dudes will get shot. They'll literally get thrown in a car, driven straight to the hospital, dropped off, like pushed out of the vehicle. The vehicle takes off. They're inside of an ER getting their, you know, chest massaged inside of 20, 30 minutes from getting shot, if even that. So that city may have a very low homicide rate, but you pull their shootings, their bullets into bodies, and they could have three times the amount of gun violence of other cities, but their hospitals are so good.
Make sure everybody knows, again, folks, you can tell already if you haven't, if you're not excited now, you can check out their podcast, The Disruptors Podcast. You can find it, I think it's everywhere, Apple, Spotify, wherever it is there. And you can also, it's got some great episodes. You have episode 13, they have Matthew Thomas, aka Deputy underscore One Time. I think I follow him on Instagram as well. He tells about the untold fight against the Mexican cartels, which a lot of the stuff they're telling me sounds a lot of cartel activity. Cartels are known to go give Christmas gifts during the holidays and things of that nature, and backpacks during the school year, and ingratiate themselves.
I'm glad you brought him up. So when we did an interview with him, and if you read his book came out maybe like 2 months ago, something like that. So that's what we joked about, because we love music, and we always, you know, talk about our favorite bands or music that we're influenced by. But Deputy One Time there, Matthew Thomas, grew up in like Section 8 housing. He told a story. He starts our episode talking about, and I won't give it away, but he's it's like the late 80s, and he's at a rap concert. And but anyway, he's got a really cool background, cool story. But yeah, he did cartel work. He did some undercover drug work, but he also did cartel work in the field, where basically their units were having to learn how to do patrols in the desert environment, go set up surveillance, do some LPOPs, all that stuff. And I don't want to give it away, but the book is really, really good in the fact that it reads just like he's sitting there, almost like we're talking now, and he's just telling you this is how it was. It's none of the like beating my chest, I'm the greatest cop ever. Very approachable. It's more, hey, this is how we worked it as a team. This was the information we were learning from other people. We were learning tracking techniques. And he's got photos in there of like some of the tricks that mules or transporters would use, which is pretty cool. Like one of them is carpet. These dudes would cut out pieces of carpet, you know, and tie it to their shoes. So when they're walking across the desert, it doesn't leave it leaves like a dispersed footprint, if even that. And so it's very hard to kind of track, but just cool little things like that and a lot of really cool photos. But that dude's, he was great, man. We could have talked to him for like 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, I've never interviewed. I had to call him up. I mean, contact him and see if he would do an interview.
He would. And the reason I say would is just like, he's just a really cool guy. He and I were messaging this morning about just the 1%er world, you know, the motorcycle clubs that are spreading and how much beef and feuds are going on and what different regions are like and stuff. So he's kind of like, it's cool to meet someone who's like us in a different region, and he's out in Arizona near the border. And so it's cool whenever we find the things that are very similar, but also find the things that are like, oh damn, like they got to deal with border stuff where we don't. They've been dealing with cartels for decades, where we're just now starting to experience some of that and see that those tentacles reach into our street gangs here. And I won't go too far into that, but yeah, it's cool. He's a good guy. And we try to find guests like that. We interviewed Tim O'Hara, who was a drummer for a punk rock band, the Lillingtons, right? And he tells an amazing story about, and I won't give that away, but of rolling up on a car crash when he was on tour and what all happened. And now he works basically on an ambulance crew. And is working basically like a paramedic or EMS, EMT. And I know there's different categories, and I apologize, but really, really cool guy. And it was cool to talk to him about his passion for trying to just save people and be a better human being. But we can still talk about punk rock and like what it did, you know, for us and that sort of thing. But yeah, we have a lot of fun, man. We enjoy the show.
Well, it's interesting because every time I talk to you, I haven't talked to Ski very much before, but I know when I talk to you and Wayne, it's just so such a big topic, gangs. And like, when you're describing them earlier, it's almost like I'm a baseball fan, so I'm not very familiar with football. But with baseball, it just sounds like there's catchers and there's pitchers and there's first basemen. You're going to need to know how they operate in their positions to be able to manage and deal with those guys. And then every team plays a little differently. Some teams are have faster players, or they have one guy that can hit the home runs, like a Barry Bonds type of guy or Aaron Judge or whatever it is. And it kind of, at least to me, is similar. I can see that correlation between that and sports teams. You have to understand who the players are. It always brings me back to The Wire. I mm-hmm. thought The Wire did such a great depiction of the different roles that these guys play. Am I far off on that, skier?
No, not at all. I mean, and actually The Wire was very, very well written as far mm-hmm. as, you know, accuracy. Obviously, there's some Hollywood drama added into there, but as far as like what street level police work looks like, they did a great job at capturing that. So, you know, for those that are listening that want to get into the police work, you watch The Wire and don't do the dirty stuff that comes along with it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that too.
You're 100% right. And, you know, it just, you know, it's funny because people put so much vested time and stuff and to learn sports like you're talking about, like with baseball, right? And if you really dive into these gangs, you can literally, you can point out the positions and whose role is what. And, you know, your strong players, you know, your weak players. And, you know, that's how you start to strategize when it comes to taking these guys down, you know, from a let's remove this set from our city. And, you know, you gotta be smart about it. Right. It's no different than, you know, two baseball teams scouting each other and trying to figure out, all right, how are we going to win this? Right. And
don't
hey,
the judge, don't pitch
and don't,
the judge.
And don't think they're not doing the same thing to us. Think about that. Right. We've got, in most major cities, you've got four rotating squads that cover the city 365 days a year and 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, right? So let's just call it, you know, squad one and two. They might be known for being, yeah, those, you know, those guys are working this weekend and they don't ever get out on us. They don't ever stop us. So it's a free-for-all, right? Well, when squad three comes on, oh, man, that's the squad you get. You don't go stand out and sell crack, because every time they drive by, they're going to stop you. They're going to ask about the flag in your back pocket or your bandana, right? So they're doing the same thing to us as we're doing to them. You got to be smart enough to understand that too.
Wonder where Paul Lozada falls into all that. What squad does Paul fall into?
Yeah, Paul would be the guy, like, you know, they would all know him on the street and they would be like, all right, Lozada's working, like, all right, shut it down. Yeah.
I think you're doing a good job when, you know, let's just call it a rookie gang member's out there running his mouth, right? And you roll up and you got one of these senior gang members that tells him to shut up because you're dealing with cops that are going to actually handle business. That's when you need to give yourself a pat on the back and go, maybe my reputation with these guys is like pretty good. Like, I'm reasonable to talk to. However, they know we're not going to put up with any of their stuff either, right? Like, we're locked in on it. So.
Oh, and we, too far off.
Yeah, and I would say, like, you know, yeah, The Wire is very, very accurate. I mean, like, and I won't go into all the details, but yeah, that's like the one show when you watch it, you know, whoever wrote it experienced either through riding with them, which I think is actually what happened, and paid attention to all the small things that you battle on a task force like that, and you're trying to dismantle an actual criminal organization. And working informants and all that. I mean, it was really good. One of the things that, you know, Ski and I always joke about is we like to laugh and joke with anybody. So we always had a good rapport wherever we were going with gang members. And so even teaching sometimes, I've heard people at breaks, you know, talking about and bragging about, well, I did this, I did that. You know, they're like, they're trying to like outdo one another, but they're always talking about like gang members in like the them term, you know. We always tell people like, We're not, it's not us versus them. We don't want you to look at it as like them and it's us versus it. It's like an ideology and you're actually trying to save that gang member from making the world's worst life choices. So when you build that rapport, you laugh and joke, but you also say things like sometimes you pull up on the block and just say, you know, as you're talking like, hey, who's going to get shot tonight? And they're just like, man, don't talk like that. Like, no, you know, it's a reality. I'm just curious. There's 10 guys hanging out here. Who's got the most beef with somebody and who's probably going to get shot tonight. And because you have to, when guys are in like day-to-day survival mode, sometimes they're not even thinking about, wow, this is a dumb choice to stand in the same block every day, defend this area or defend this hotel we sell out of when our enemy's going to roll by and know we're standing here flat-footed and stitch us up, you know? So a lot of times our ideas were to go by, ride, talk it, you know, just kind of talk it up with them and say, hey, basically, if you got beef, don't be on the block. You know what I mean? Like, don't stand out here. You're a standing target. And what we're trying to do is like not have to respond to a shooting or get involved with something like that. And then what you do is you basically say, hey, I hope nobody gets shot tonight. Like, that's what I don't want to happen. Like, y'all do whatever you got to do, man. And if you're going to be out, you know, here selling stuff, yeah, you're going to get our attention, but the violence is what we're tracking. So if you guys can be cool with everybody, then you're not going to get our attention. But if you're violent and Ski was on a unit where they knew very specifically these career criminals, and when they got cases on them, and I'll let Ski just talk about it. I think are you about to jump in on that, Ski?
No, I was just kind of reminiscing in my own brain. It's a sad thing when you see a 15, 16-year-old kid that you've been telling, hey, you need to walk away from this, and then fast forward 5-6 years, that same kid that you built a rapport with, you're responding to that gunshot wound, and you walk up, and it's him, right? And you know him because you've been dealing with him for 5-6 years, day in and day out, and you're literally watching him take his last breaths out in the middle of the road with blood pooling all over the place, crack rocks still in his mouth because he's still selling crack to try and, you know, make that little bit of money, and that's the only life he knows. And it's just such a vicious cycle. And, you know, some people might look at it, all right, another gang member dead, but like, man, these are people too, man. Like, a lot of these kids, they're just victim of circumstance. And I know some people will disagree with that and say, oh, this Ski guy's soft and this and that. No, sit down and talk with these guys and you'll realize that they are a victim of circumstance, and they literally know no different life. You know, that's what they know. But
let me ask you guys this. You got so many questions, and I'm running out of time. Always happens, BC. Always happens.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a talker too. That's the problem.
That's good. No, you answered a lot of good questions too. But there's about four questions I know I want to ask. One, we'll get into the drugs in a little bit. How prevalent are those? What's the number one drug? We'll get into that later if there is such a thing as a number one drug. And then ghost guns, because we keep hearing this kind of thing floating around.
Yeah.
But before we get to those two questions, I wanted to make sure we ensure we got gangs, guns, and drugs into the conversation. Yeah. Folks, again, we're talking to the Disruptors, BC and Ski. You can find their podcast, the Disruptors Podcast. Definitely check it out. Along the same lines here, because now I'm starting to get a kind of a vibe from both of you, which I think is very, very great. It's a great viewpoint, and it's very admirable the way you look at them and the respect that you give them as well, and looking at them as human beings and not just criminals.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes me think, because I know I've seen stories, we've seen it in the movies. Have you encountered a lot of these individuals, like the ones you see in the streets or the Ski that mentioned a minute ago, victims of circumstance? Are they sometimes locked in because maybe they're the only ones bringing money into the family, or they're bringing enough to sustain the family? Have you seen that kind of issue?
Yeah, I'll start out and BC can wrap it up. It's hard for these kids that grow up in these neighborhoods and then they get brought into these gangs. It's hard for them to just walk away, because where are they going, right? A lot of these kids have never left like that 10 block radius where they grew up, right? Mm-hmm. So that's their whole life. So as far as them not being able to get out, they don't have any money. They probably don't have a whole lot of family to turn to, and all their friends are in the gang that they're in, right? So they just don't have anywhere to turn, right? And as I think we started out talking about that, a lot of that's like the 47 guys out of the 50 that don't want to be there, but they don't really have a choice, right? I do think it ebbs and flows too. I think in the beginning they probably like it because it's new and it's exciting, but then they realize that lifestyle, you know, like, who wants to go, you know, walk down the street every single day and go, is today the day that I'm going to catch one to the head? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, but there are some guys, and you got to think about it like this too, is, you know, depending on your involvement in the gang, there might be some guys that the gang can't just let walk away because they know too much, right? If that guy gets out and he gets out of our control, he knows everything about us. And if you look at like RICO cases and stuff, they use a lot of historical. Right. If somebody knows too much, they might just say like, hey, you're with us, and if you try and leave, we're just going to kill you. Your own gang's going to take you out because it's too dangerous for them to walk away and risk getting intercepted by law enforcement or telling people that gang's business. And, you know, then they're, you know, then they've been compromised. So I think
that reminds me of the Black Hand, wasn't it his name from the Mexican mafia?
Yeah. Rene, I won't say Enriquez, but I know who you're talking about. They called him a boxer, right?
Boxer, yeah.
Talking about, yeah.
Rene Enriquez Jr.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I was actually just telling a group of prosecutors and lawyers. I was talking to them yesterday, and they wanted to know a few good books to read. And I was like, yeah, read this one. You know what boxers. I mean? Like, this will show you. And I want to say he was like Florencia 13, but he had started out like with a Sereno click. And then got arrested and went to jail and then joined, you know, he basically had to join the Mexican mafia, and the next 20 or something like that, 20, 30 years he stayed in. But just an amazing read to show you that how, and if I remember right, all the details, like his family was not gang related. Like he didn't have that, that kind of template that they teach us in sociology classes. Like, oh, well, kids are born in this environment. They just don't know what to do. They're going to join the gang. And sometimes it is fast track that way. Like you said, like if the family's kind of the structure's breaking apart, it's a lot easier. But we've also dealt with families where, you know, two family members, one can be in like med school, one can be whatever in the military. Mm-hmm. And then one is just hardcore. I love being a gang member, you know? And so like in the South, we have this term where grandmothers will be like, yeah, well, that one wanted to step off the porch too early. And what that means is like they wanted to get out there in the street. You know, they wanted to go out there for their own personal reasons, but the family never lived like that. You know, the cousins and the brothers and everybody, they were working, and not, it was not like a family thing to have this gang involvement. And so one of the things like you had asked earlier, I think, about the family stuff is some of these guys, though, now in the South, we're dealing with the second generation. So now we have guys who have joined gangs, you know, 15, 20 years ago, have reproduced. And now that their kids are now of age 15, 16, where they're joining gangs. And guess what? They remember the stories of their mom and their dad and everybody hanging out. And, oh, yeah, y'all used to carry a pistol. Well, I got this chopper. I got this AK now. You know, y'all used to sell crack. Well, I'm moving Molly now, you know, or I'm moving heroin now, or I got this plug, you know, and I'm moving kilos of coke, and I got big hardware. And it's almost like they want to do it bigger and better than that generation before them. If that makes sense.
What is the drugs?
Very similar.
What is the drug of choice today now? I hate to interrupt you, but I know we're
running out of time. No, it's a really good question. So like now, like you heard Ski talking about crack dominated for a long time. It's demand driven. You know what I mean? Like, so now a lot of people want heroin? Pills. Yeah, heroin, pills, and Molly, ecstasy, some of the designer drugs you're starting to see street level or in and out of hotels. Like a lot of our guys, because we pushed them off the corners, now utilize very inexpensive hotels.
It's the same cast of characters again, heroin and Molly.
You know, heroin used to be very, like you could track it in different like demographics, but now it's everybody wants it, and everybody wants the pills. And when someone overdoses on heroin, that's like a commercial for, hey, come buy this heroin because it's so good, you're gonna overdose or come close to overdosing. Yeah. So it's the opposite. When someone overdoses, everybody starts texting and calling one another and being like, you know, this plug or this dude right here has got the fire. Like he's got what you want because so-and-so overdosed. Now everybody goes to buy that hot batch, and the person who just sold that bit of heroin now has larger customer base coming in. So the hot batch or the batch of heroin that probably has a lot of fentanyl in it that's causing people to overdose is moving twice as fast. So it's hard for law enforcement to catch up and get that dealer off the street when they're selling heroin that's killing people. And now you're seeing so much fentanyl coming in and people's tolerance getting so high. Also Narcan or these agents that you can spray in the nose and stuff that brings people back to life. So you'll have your statistics. You could have a 20% increase in overdoses, but that's not that you got all these new users. It's people who are surviving their overdoses. So one person may overdose 4 or 5 times in a year. Whereas before Narcan, they would have overdosed and died. You know, it would have been lethal.
Jeez, so your statistics friend had 4 overdoses in 1 day.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're so if you're studying statistics, not to nerd out, but if you're studying statistics, you got to understand that that's going to curve or skew your results because one person may overdose multiple times because Narcan or whatever agent they use is keeping them from dying. Go ahead, Ski.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you want to learn a lot about some of the stuff, and we can talk a whole episode on fentanyl, which is probably one of the biggest problems, which is what they're cutting a lot of drugs with and all sorts of different drugs. We had a guy on our show named Brock Bevel, and he's a retired police officer, went through his own addiction struggles, but he's got a couple really cool pages. He's got a podcast called Chase the Vase, which if you want to learn a lot about this drug and recovery stuff. And then he's also got Victory Recovery is a thing that he runs on Instagram, a page that he runs and a program. But fentanyl is probably the biggest drug you're going to hear everything about right now because of how lethal it is and how widespread it is and how quickly it's killing people. And it's just such a small amount of fentanyl that can kill so many people. So look up Brock Bevel, Victory Recovery, and the Chase the Base podcast if you want to learn more on that stuff.
Yeah, folks, here it is. It's Brock Bevel, B-E-V-E-L-L. And you can find their episode with the Disruptors podcast as well if you want to check that out. Chase the Base and Victory Recovery, as he was mentioning. It's Victory Recovery AZ. That's the handle on Instagram. And his handle on Instagram is Brock Bevel. He's got some interesting stuff that I highly recommend. Yeah, really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I have to reach out to
yeah,
snagging guests here.
Do it, man. That guy, he is motivating. I actually had a person less than a week ago reach out to me, and she said she was battling her own alcohol addiction, and she and her husband and kids were moving, relocating, and she was listening to the podcast, and she said that, you know, that was amazing to hear someone, because he will explain to you about addiction, what it's like being a cop and working drugs and actually getting addicted and his battles and other stuff he's gotten into in law enforcement, but just a really good guy to talk to. So yeah, if you can get him on the show or people listen to that episode, reach out to him on Instagram. He loves talking to people. It's good for him too. You know, so
what was that name of that movie? Wasn't it Ethan Hawke that played a cop that was addicted to drugs?
You talking about Rush? You tell me it wasn't Ethan. Well, maybe he was, but there was a movie called Rush with I forget his name. He was the dude from Lost Boys and Jennifer Jason Leigh. But Rush was maybe one was about. Rush. Yeah, it was where he was like a narcotics detective and he got addicted.
So there were a couple of them. So there was an episode of Hill Street Blues too. I think where one of the officers there got addicted. Remember that?
Yeah.
One?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm aging myself now.
No. Hill Street Blues is good. People should go back and watch it, man. That's good stuff. But no, it's. Check out Brock Bevel, man. He's good. We've been fortunate to have a lot of really good guests on the podcast.
That's a great podcast, and I think it'd be really great for the audience to go check it out. Like we told you before, we're not afraid to share podcast information, podcasts that we find are good and enlightening. So, folks, go check it out. I guess my last question here as we start wrapping up, it's amazing. We could be here for like 5 hours. We'll have to set up like a series with you guys.
Let's do it again.
We'll have to do like a series. We'll have to do like a gang series or something. And maybe I'll even bring a former gang member. That'd be kind of fascinating.
Yeah,
that's always interesting. Ghost guns. I keep hearing this. At least in California, we hear it a lot. I think they started to have some problems. I don't know if they started, but I know I saw at least a news headline over in New York as well. Anything on your side of the country?
Yeah. You want me to go ahead and handle it, Ski? You good?
Yes.
Okay. So ghost guns is like the buzzword. So a lot of people, a lot of people like really perk up when they hear that. I mean, it's a gun and it kills people. And about probably, I don't know. I mean, off the top of my head, I wouldn't even know, but a lot of the guns that are committed in murders that I've experienced, we don't always recover them. You know what I mean? So while it's a ghost gun, I don't want to get into like all of the politics of all that stuff. It's a pistol, you know, that someone can make, and, you know, it doesn't have the stampings or the numbers, or whatever. It's not made by a manufacturer necessarily, so people can't track it or trace it or whatever, but it still operates as a gun. So you can tie ballistically bullets, you know, to that weapon if you can recover it. You know what I mean? So it's not, I mean, we love to recover weapons in homicides, but it's very, very hard, gang related homicides, I should say. Because as soon as that homicide's done, a lot of people get rid of the guns very quickly, and they're changing hands constantly. Even with your ballistics labs, when you're matching up shell cases just from shootings or like even shots fired, like where someone comes and dumps a mag, 30 shell casings in a cul-de-sac somewhere, and we check it and you know, ballistically match it to other weapons, you know, or other shell casings. It's like, well, this shell casing matching up like three jurisdictions away less than a week ago. You know what I mean? Then you're like, oh, well, what about before that? Oh, well, you know, a year ago it was in wherever, you know? So the ghost gun thing, it's a buzzword, I think. And people were really, they can use it for whatever means they want to get a certain political angle or whatever. I mean, my thing is just a gun is a gun. Our goal is to keep gang members from pulling that trigger or any kind of organized drug dealer. But I don't personally get too hung up on them.
Are you seeing an uptick in revolvers?
You know,
I keep hearing that, but I don't know if it's just kind of like an urban legend or myth.
Well, meaning like a lot of people be like, oh, use a revolver because it doesn't leave shell casings. But I will tell you this. I mean, we're not giving away trade secrets like gang members are doing it. They're picking up shell casings. You know what I'm saying? Like these dudes are, some of these dudes are so bold when they shoot, you know, and you can see it. You can track guys will get on a corner, fire two or three shots and take off running. Now we're seeing guys stand somewhere and we've had multiple people stand there with multiple weapons and just light up a hotel, a house, a trailer, whatever, flat footed. Like they don't have a care in the world because they're not being conditioned by constant stops by police, a lot of proactive investigations in their gang. And so we may get to a shooting and there'll be 60 shell casings out there with four or five different calibers, which, you know, 5-10 years ago was almost unheard of. People would shoot very quickly and get out of the area so you don't get caught. Now it's like, oh, well. So the ghost gun thing is like we've seen more ghost guns or whatever, however you want to term it, like whatever the nomenclature, P90, whatever. But we're seeing them, but it's just because they're more prevalent and we're having a lot more stolen firearms because a lot more firearms were sold after, you know, riots and the pandemic. And so the average citizen's going out and buying pistols and rifles. And then their home gets broken into or their car gets broken into and their weapons are being stolen. And now you've got gang members. Yeah, go ahead.
Out of curiosity, guys, I've heard that it's a strange question, but I'm just thinking as you're talking about this and I'm wondering, I've heard people say, oh, criminals are going to go to the gun shows and buy guns because it's a little easier to get through the background checks and this and that. And I know I saw a DOJ study a while back ago. It was a long time ago. They haven't done one for a while, I don't think. I think they say like 80% of the guns used in crimes are usually illegally obtained, whether a lot of times it's just a friend or a cousin or something like that. Just give them a gun. Like we had the San Bernardino shooters. I think it was their neighbor who gave it to him. Would they be so bold as to go to a gun show? I mean, or is that just completely fantasy land?
Well, go ahead, Ski. Yeah.
I think the easiest way to look at it is they're going to obtain a firearm in any way they possibly can. So they might send their girlfriend or somebody to the gun show that can lead the straw purchase to purchase a handful of firearms and then disperse them back out to the street, pay that person, you know, a couple $100 to do it. And then they walk away. But I don't think there's one main source. I mean, a lot of guns come from car break-ins and house break-ins and B&Es and stuff. That's an easy way to get it. But just think of it like this. They want those guns and they're going to do anything they can to get it, whether it's going to a gun show, whether it's a car break-in, whether it's just, you know, seeing somebody open carry and following them and taking it from them, robbing them. You know what I mean? So I don't think there's just one main source of how they get their hands on them.
Yeah.
I don't know. In my opinion too, that, you know, certain people have good connects, but guns are not that easy to obtain, right? Because some people don't want to get rid of them, right? Yeah, it was kind of my take because, I'd always ask, you know, people that wanted to work with us, hey, can you buy a gun? I'd rather buy a gun than dope. And more often than not, like, I don't know, they're tough to get your hands on, right? So it could be a good debate question, but basically, what do you think, man?
I don't think
they're as easy to get as people make it out to be.
No, not in the gang world. I mean, if we're talking like guns that are being used in cycles of violence, they're usually stolen guns. Or you may have someone who has a drug addiction and they run out of money. They can trade their car for drugs, right, to the dealer, and the dealer will use their car. You know, we used to call them the crack rentals for a long time. But or they can take you know, their grandfather's shotguns and rifles and pistols, take them to the dealer and trade the guns for drugs. So we would see some really crazy weapons being used and go, man, that's like a, you know, like a 1960s era 12 gauge or like a 44 yard long barrel, whatever. It's like a musket. And then you figure out like, oh yeah, that was, you know, this like good old boy coming from his grandfather's place where he stole the family firearms and traded them for drugs. It's, I mean, most gang members, at least our experience, most gang members are not mess. They don't have to mess with a gun show. They'll do the straw purchase. They'll have a girlfriend with a clean record. And sometimes there are some telltale signs we won't go into to be able to figure out it's a straw purchase, meaning somebody goes in with a clean record, buys several firearms, turns right around and gives them to the boyfriend or the friend. And he in turn turns and sells them on the street or uses them in a crime or does whatever. But for the most part, man, it's just a lot of stolen firearms out there. The thing that we look at is we can have all the guns in the U.S. that we want. That the guns are not the problem. It is the mindset that a gang member wants that gun and they're going to commit violence. Now, what we've seen the uptick in is gang members actively carrying the pistol for no reason other than they just want to own them. Where 5-10 years ago, Ski and I would be debriefing people and say, like, you know, basically, like, where do y'all stash your weapons? So when everybody's posting up and selling drugs, they may put a gun underneath like the tire of an abandoned car. You know, they don't want the pistol on them. They may want it readily available, or they'll pop the trunk and kind of put a rifle in the trunk and ease the trunk down. But they don't want to own their person because they don't want to get caught because their fellow gang members are doing fed time because our local agents and officers were focusing on the guns. Now, because there's such less proactive policing, and we talked to other jurisdictions, and that's how it is there too. Car stops, there are gang members in a car, four gang members in a car. Everybody's got a pistol in their waistband, and they'll have like a small chopped down rifle or shotgun or something in the back seat. Like they dudes just don't care anymore because the chances are they're probably not going to get stopped anyway. Now you got a carload of dudes just rolling around because it's fun and posting videos with extended magazine Glocks and stuff. And now they bump into someone they don't like at a gas station or convenience store, and they're doing mag dumps and miss and hit, you know, some citizen. So it's this idea of like gang members having guns on them has also probably perpetuated a lot of the drug or the gang violence, gun violence, because they have them on them. Go ahead, Ski.
Crazy.
No, guys, I have a hard stop, but I appreciate the invite, and I can't wait to yeah, listen man. To the rest of y'all's conversation.
yeah.
Dr. Carlos, thank you so much, man, and hopefully we get to do this again soon.
Well, man, I can't believe, like I said, it's been an hour already. It's time for us to wrap up, but yeah, we definitely have to bring you guys back, and I'm looking at options for a future episode. I don't think it'd be fascinating if I can find them. It's never that easy to try to find international cops to talk about their gangs and have y'all just kind of like your accent's rubbing off on me now. To have all you guys, talk about gangs.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fascinating to see that. Or actually, no, I was talking to one individual, which might be cool too. I think it might have been you. It was you or somebody else talking about bringing somebody like you and Ski as well. And then somebody who works within the prison system. And see how they communicate with each other. Because I think that'd be fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know me, I'll talk to anybody, man. I love it. And we got to get you on, man. We got to crack open that brain and talk about some of the good stuff that you
do. Oh, yes. I'm excited for that too. Can't wait to be on the Disruptors. I don't know about the music part because I don't have to take you to the 80s, but
that's perfect, man. We talk about old soul. We take it back to the 50s, man. Music is music. It never gets old.
Folks, once again, BC and Ski, you can catch their podcast called the Disruptors Podcast. It's everywhere on Apple, Google, Spotify, and whatnot. And you know what to do, folks. Make sure to share, subscribe, hit that like button. We'll talk to you all soon.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.